Go on, give me a round of applause. Thank you. Let's start as we mean to go on. Well, thank you for the invitation and thank you so much for coming. I know it's lunchtime and we probably want a bit of a nap, especially in such dark times and who knows what might happen tomorrow, but I'm going to leave that aside. The title of my talk today, Dark, Utopian Dark Times, is borrowed from the title of a chapter in an academic book written by Ruth Levitas and Lucy Sargerson. These two women are very significant thinkers within the field of utopian studies. And in 2001 to 2002, they wrote a series of letters to one another, which was then transcribed into a chapter for a book called Dark Horizons. And in this series of letters, it's quite curious to think that the letters were started before the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Organization, and then they continue some months afterwards. And given that the subject of these letters is the balance between optimism and pessimism, what role does the utopian imagination have in the contemporary political and social landscape, it's a really curious kind of watershed sort of moment, I guess. And Ruth Levitas writes in one of her letters to Lucy, "Dear Lucy, you asked me to explain why I'm so pessimistic about the possible role of utopia in the contemporary world. The answer stems from the reason why I became interested in utopianism in the first place. I wanted and still want the world to be changed. Our current social arrangements condemn most of the world's population to poverty and premature death, and subject even those of us who are very affluent to forms of alienation, repression, competition, and separation from each other, which are incompatible with a fully human existence. I don't believe this is necessary. So the strongest and best function of utopia must be the exploration of alternatives in a way that supports or catalyzes social transformation." In Levitas's letter to Lucy Sargerson, then, this idea that a fully human existence is being denied to us because of the kind of contemporary conditions of our life in late capitalism, leads into this idea that utopia stems from a desire for catalysing social transformation, for bringing about change. But Levitas is worried that it's being confined to being merely a bearer of consolation or a vehicle of criticism rather than really fully kind of catalysing the kind of change that she would like to see. So although they were corresponding in the early 2000s, this kind of situation in which we should be worried about the utopian imagination, we should seek to nourish and protect and extend its possibilities, is something that I would suggest has become even more entrenched. So since 2001, since they were corresponding then, the tectonic geopolitical crisis of the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Organization, on the World Trade Center, ignited a belligerent foreign policy discourse during the so-called War on Terror across the Bush and then into the Obama years. And this favoured military interventions, as we all know, into the Middle East and Asia in the name of American security, and it privileged that kind of militarisation over long-term diplomacy, economic development and soft power. But also, of course, the global financial crisis of 2008 to 2009, which we're still very much feeling and reeling from the effects of today, is another kind of tectonic shift in the 21st century. It's inspired subsequent waves of popular protest across North America, Europe and throughout the Arab world, and has caused the largest political upheaval since decolonisation in the Middle East. So young protesters, particularly of a younger generation, have been occupying public spaces. They've been protesting against corporate greed, political power and elites. They've been ousting dictators in some areas, Gaddafi in Libya, Mubarak in Egypt. But, of course, also these protests have led to incredibly complex political crises in the region, civil war in Yemen and Syria, and then, of course, the strengthening of terrorism in areas across Iraq and also Syria. Commentators were quick to point out alarming echoes of the 1929 Wall Street crash and the Great Depression of the 1930s after the financial crisis. Comparisons which, as David Coates writes, revived interest in Keynesian fiscal stabilisation policies as major world economies tried stimulus programmes to stave off depression and spur economic recovery. So there was initially a Keynesian revival and then an anti-Keynesian reaction set in as the recovery took hold and the politicians and the public turned their concern again to deficits and to debt. The American economist Paul Krugman wrote at the time in 2008 in an analysis called The Return of Depression Economics that, and I quote, the kinds of problems that characterized much of the world economy in the 1930s have not been seen since, have staged a stunning comeback. 15 years ago, hardly anybody thought that modern nations would be forced to endure bone-crushing recessions for fear of currency speculators, and that major advanced nations would find themselves persistently unable to generate enough spending to keep their workers and their factories employed. So as neoliberalist capitalism struggled through this latest in a series of financial crises, if you have the long durée view back to the 19th century and so on, the response by various governments to respond to spiralling debt by imposing austerity cuts, so for instance here in the UK, but also across Europe, Germany, France, the Baltic states, particularly Latvia and of course Greece, recalled the 1930s in another sense in addition to the purely financial one. And that is this political sense, the sense of emptying out of a kind of political mainstream and this emergence of an increasing number of political parties, organisations, pressure groups and so on, moving further to the left and to the right. We see, for instance, then Podemos, the left-wing populist movement in Spain, which was only founded in 2014 and has hit the traditional socialist party very hard. In Greece, meanwhile, we have Syriza, the coalition of parties on the so-called radical left, founded into, that's not them, by the way, I do realise that, sorry, I'm coming to that, in 2004, which has attracted voters away from traditional left-wing social democratic parties like PASOK. But then, of course, as you can see pictured here, the frightening rise of the far-right party Golden Dawn, with a xenophobic ultranationalism and this neo-Nazi culture in which we see violent gangs attacking people on the street with impunity being protected by members in the Greek government. In the UK, we've witnessed support for UKIP, which received almost 27% share of the vote in the 2015 election, but possibly has waned since then. And more recently, support for Jeremy Corbyn from among the left wing of the Labour Party, opposing the Parliamentary Labour Party in many cases, and supported by organisations like Momentum, very much galvanising young people into a new generation of Labour and left-wing politics. In France, the increasing support of the right-wing Front National, with Marine Le Pen receiving almost 40% of the vote share in May's presidential elections, reaffirms the dangers of fascism in today's world. And then, of course, the election to the French presidency of Emmanuel Macron reminds us of just how quickly things are changing. His movement En Marche, this new liberal centrist movement, is only a year old and he as yet doesn't have any elected representatives. So things are changing quite rapidly. In a text called Creeping Fascism, Brexit, Trump and the Rise of the Far Right, published a couple of months ago, Neil Faulkner contrasts what he calls the first wave sledgehammer fascism of the interwar period with our own second wave of creeping fascism. As he writes, although there are distinct structural differences between these two historical moments, the 1930s, the 2010s, in the hollowed out spaces, he says, of the neoliberal dystopia, in the social vacuum created by the system's rampant individualism, consumerism and greed, fascists can quickly attract a mass following. The human wreckage of the capitalist crisis becomes the raw material for fashioning new fascist movements around the myths of nation, race, and family. So Faulkner describes a kind of newly emergent mass base on which these neo-fascist movements are increasingly having an impact. He calls them the human dust. It's a curious phrase. He seems to use it because he suggests there isn't a clear class basis for the people upon which fascism is gathering support. He says, rather than clearly defined classes, what we're seeing are agglomerations of discontented individuals unified around a cocktail of blood and soil mysticism, anti-migrant and Islamophobic racism, and a large dose of psychotic rage, his words, facilitated, as we see on a daily basis, by our massively increased global communications coverage on the internet, trolling the vitriol and the aggressiveness of people towards one another online. But the image that Faulkner uses, this human dust image, I think is quite provocative, and it reminds us of the enormous complexity of contemporary politics, where we have rapidly changing allegiances, a fragmentation of traditional political divisions between left and right, and also the withering away of traditional signifiers of class. It's no longer straight straightforward or clear cut to say if you own property, you belong to a propertied class or not. If you work in manual or white collar work, these things are no longer clear anymore in the 21st century. And this image of dust is one that brought to my mind, at least, the German utopian philosopher Ernst Bloch, about whom I'm going to be talking today. He used the image to describe the insidious slide into Nazism in the 1930s, referring to the rise of National Socialism in his prescient analysis, Erbschaft dieser Zeit, translated as Heritage of Our Times or Heritage of This Times, which was published in 1935. He called it an accretion of dust, of staleness, or of mustiness in claustrophobic images of mute complicity. And I quote, "The close, stale air still greets even those who are not breathing it. It seeps down to the young man and up to the beautiful people, keeps him good and quiet, keeps them good and deaf. No one," he says, "believes it could be done to them." His writing is poetic. It's informed by movements in expressionism and avant-garde aesthetics, which I'll come on to in a moment. But I think what's really interesting here is the way in which fascism manages to colonise and appeal to various parts of the national consciousness and unconscious kind of psyche. Something, he says, becomes different. From below, a thrust runs on. Here, the air is perhaps not quite so heavy as before, but it does not blow yet, it just raises dust. So in our own times, our own dark times of post-truth politics, embodied by figures like Donald Trump and Nigel Farage, we're finding these kind of frightening echoes of populist movements of the 1930s. What I'd like to do today, and I don't mean to generalise by any means, so I'll try and be as focused as I possibly can, because these are obviously very difficult political and historical questions. But what I'd like to do is sketch out Ernst Bloch's thinking and the way in which some of his ideas about utopia and the utopian imagination remain crucial to helping us confront the increasingly dystopian period now in the 2010s with a kind of utopian counterweight. I'm going to look at a few of his ideas to offer just some brief thoughts on defending the utopian imagination in today's political climate, and particularly thinking about it in terms of time, lived time or temporality, in response to the title of this exhibition, Time Machines. So to start off with then, Ernst Bloch, who was he? He's a very dour-looking man and mostly photographed in his older age. This is by far the most fun image that I could find of him, so I leave it there to try and cheer us all up a little bit. I'll just give you some facts about him. He is the most significant utopian thinker to date. His immense oeuvre, of which the three-volume The Principle of Hope, which was published in the late 1930s and into the 1940s, is illustrative, sketches out the persistence of the utopian impulse even in the darkest times. Writing in the early 1930s, as Hitler's National Socialism was taking hold of the German national consciousness, Bloch insisted on the importance of utopian thinking and developed a unique model of time, of kind of multi-stranded time, which opens up utopian insights into the present, insights which we might suggest act like time machines, landing in the unfathomable present from the past and the future. So as you can see from, I hope you can all read that, by the way, from a few key facts here, he was born in the later 19th century, part of a lively and very important generation of German thinkers, whose ideas about politics, philosophy, and aesthetics continue to shape our own contemporary readings in cultural theory. So he was friends with well-known figures such as the Hungarian philosopher Georg Lukács, the German thinker Walter Benjamin. He also had maintained friendships with Theodor Adorno, the founder of the Institute of Social Research, also known as the Frankfurt School, the composer Hans Eisler, the theologian Paul Tillich. He was a member of Max Weber's group in Heidelberg. Weber, of course, one of the fathers of modern sociology, and he was also part of a private colloquium run by Georg Simmel in Berlin. He met with writers, artists and composers like Thomas Mann, Bertolt Brecht and Igor Stravinsky. So why, given all of these prolific figures at that time, you might ask, is Ernst Bloch relatively unknown? And there are a lot of good reasons for that, not least of which is, as you will come to see, unfortunately, his writing is quite difficult to interpret and difficult often to understand. But nonetheless, what really fascinates what me about Ernst Bloch is he had a very long lifespan, and there's this kind of strange coincidence in which the facts of his birth and living at that time meant that he witnessed some of the greatest changes in the early to mid-20th century. Born in 1880s Germany in an industrial town, he then experienced World War I, during which time he was a pacifist. He had a very personal experience of the financial crisis after the Wall Street crash of 1929, because his then wife, who was a Russian heiress to an industrial fortune, which vanished overnight, and they were suddenly cast out and destitute. His third wife was a member actively involved with the German Communist Party, the KPD, and her family were murdered by the Nazis during the Second World War. Carola and Bloch fled to the United States, where he lived as an émigré German intellectual. He didn't speak English, he wasn't able to find work. And so he had a very difficult time of it. And then coming back after the Second World War, he finally got a post, his first academic position in his 60s, in Leipzig, in the GDR, in East Germany. And he was very influential on a whole generation of East German and also West German philosophers and students at the time. But his unorthodox approach to Marxist theory meant that the Stalinist authorities started to put increasing pressure on him, trying to get him to stick to the party line, which he didn't do, and eventually branding him an anti-Marxist seducer of youth, something I aspire to be. And it led to him narrowly escaping arrest and then fleeing to West Germany just in the year, in 1961, when the Berlin Wall was being constructed. For him, that was the final straw. He then spent the last few years of his life at Tübingen in West Germany. And in his inaugural lecture at the age of 76, he posed the question, can hope be disappointed? And in spite, he responded, of many personal and political disappointments, both on behalf of himself and of his generation, as well as those across the European continent more broadly, he suggested the historical process is open-ended and we should continue to practice hope. So he's a very interesting figure, personally and politically. So thinking about utopia then as a kind of time machine, utopia has a particular kind of relationship with time, a special temporal character, and this became very apparent in the mid to late 19th century when utopian narratives moved away from their earlier Renaissance predecessors. So the term derives, of course, from the Renaissance utopias such as Thomas More's originary text, in 1516, Tommaso Campanella's The City of the Sun, 1602, and Margaret Cavendish's The Blazing World of 1666. And so these are the kind of narratives whereby people venture off into the new world, get lost along the way, there's sometimes a sort of shipwreck narrative, and they arrive upon some hidden island and discover the perfect state, the utopia. But by the 19th century, literary utopias were responding to their own historical moment of industrialization, rapid technological progress. And so therefore, they started to situate utopia not elsewhere, somewhere elsewhere in geography, on the map, in another sea, perhaps, but they projected it into a future elsewhen. So texts such as you can see here, Mary Griffith's 300 Years Hence, an early example from 1836, William Morris's News from Nowhere in 1890, and Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward from 1888. So in these kinds of texts, we find that the temporality of utopia, the experience of time, can be identified as a sort of speculative, distant future. What might society look like in, you know, several hundred years' time? And the purpose of these novels, then, is to send a message back to the reader's present, which says, this is how we might think about society in more progressive ways. We could change the way in which we run education, transportation, you know, scientific advancements, and so on. So the protagonists travel through time to visit socially and scientifically advanced societies precisely so that they can return to their own world at the end of the text, enlightened about new ideas. And whilst these narratives do have an important political function in terms of that sense of critique, critiquing their own time, suggesting things could be made better or changed, there is also a danger, and I think this is what Ruth Levitas was talking about, as I quoted at the beginning, of restricting the utopian imagination just to literary novels, to texts, and relegating to ideas about, you know, some fantastical speculation what should really be a transformative desire for social change. As Ruth Levitas then says, utopian imaginings may be located in the future, but without any convincing account of transforming agents and processes that could turn wishful thinking into political action. So it's good, but perhaps it doesn't take us far enough. There is, of course, another way in which we might think about utopia through the metaphor of the time machine. I'm sorry, I didn't realise this was an animated GIF, so it's just going to flash the word utopia at you for the next 10 minutes. Look away if it's too difficult. And this involves, I would suggest, not thinking about utopia just as a literary genre, but actually thinking about it as a process of political imagination. This is what Marxists would refer to, I guess, as theory and praxis, the unity of thinking about things and the unity of trying to enact those things. And this is the second kind of utopian imagining which I'm going to focus on today, specifically the way in which utopian philosophy relates to the philosophy of time. This is what we call temporality, the experience of lived time. Temporality is central to Bloch's writings about the utopian imagination. He was fascinated by Jewish mysticism and the Kabbalah, and then he discovered a concept of the not yet, the noch nicht in German, or the still not, in 1907. And that then, for the duration of his long career, underpinned all of his most important philosophical ideas. So crucially, he wants to kind of excavate this idea of anticipation, anticipatory consciousness. He argues that we shouldn't just think about Freud and psychoanalysis and kind of repressed traumas of the past in the unconscious, but rather we should think about the pre-conscious, that we are somehow aware of things to come, but perhaps they're not clear, they're not quite articulated, we can't quite grasp them. This idea then of the not yet was sketched out in The Principle of Hope, which is a kind of comprehensive model of anticipatory consciousness. It covers so many different aspects. Mundane facts about everyday life in an almost anthropological sort of lens. Everyday behaviours, the excavation of historical images, motifs in literature, painting, stained glass windows, cathedral roofs, you name it. Aesthetic readings of art, music, and philosophy from the pre-Socratics onwards. For Bloch, then, this aspect of what phenomenologists would call lived time of temporality, particularly as experienced by the individual. My subjective temporality is my own experience of time, and that is often at odds with a much more public understanding of universal time, historical time, or what's often referred to as clock time, literally the ticking of the clock. And so his kind of utopian approach rescues this rational element of utopia. It's not just about social dreaming. It's not just about myths of plenty and nostalgia. It is actually grounded in a kind of rational wish for society to improve. And so he spends much of his writings thinking about historical time. Only the philosophy of history, he says, also revives what was, utopically overhauling it. It places time, the intuitive form, the operative sphere of active life at the centre. At the time in which Bloch was writing in the early decades of the 20th century, utopia had a pretty bad name, and it went on to get even worse, with all of the kind of authoritarian and totalitarian experiments from the Russian Revolution onwards into Maoist China, Stalinism and so on. Utopia became conflated with this kind of totalitarian organisation of society, a great engineering project to reconfigure human behaviours and social governance and so on. But what Bloch actually did was to kind of give a certain philosophical density, an importance, a heft to this denigrated concept of utopia. And he did this by returning it to what is actually an ontological question. So this is a question of who are we? Where are we going? He says, what are we doing? It's a question of being, essentially. And just to pause on this idea of ontology for a moment, if you think about ontology meaning the philosophical study of being, of our experience of being, a metaphysical branch dedicated to this idea of existence, how on earth are you supposed to consider utopia if it is not yet, if it is somewhere in the future, but I can also sort of see it glancing back into my own present? How do you talk about something that both does and does not exist in the here and now? In ontological terms, utopia is present right now because I anticipate it, and therefore, in an abstract sense, I could will it into being. But, of course, it is also absent in a concrete sense because it talks about something that has not yet come into fruition. So there's a paradox here. And in order to try and talk about that paradox, Bloch refers to the play Mahogany from Bertolt Brecht. And there's a quote in Mahogany, a character says, "Something is missing." And Bloch says, this sentence, which is in Mahogany, is one of the most profound sentences that Brecht ever wrote, and it is in two words. What is this something? If it is not allowed to be cast in a picture, then I shall portray it as in the process of being. But one should not be allowed to eliminate it as if it really did not exist. And so the key word here is process. He's upending, really, centuries of philosophical tradition and saying that being is not just what already exists, but it is also the process towards something that shimmers between presence and absence. So, returning to the question of fascism, then, one of the aesthetic debates which I thought I'd introduce to you today, which helps us to understand some of the things Bloch is writing about with regards to utopia, returns us to some arguments he had in the early 1930s about expressionism. So this is, of course, an artistic movement which had caused revulsion amongst prominent Nazis, as you can see here. Although Goebbels had said in 1933 that expressionism contained the seeds of some sound ideas, after a public condemnation of modern art at a party rally in Nuremberg in 1934, the Nazis turned against this idea of modern art as degenerate. They didn't like the experimentation of the expressionist painters. They cited the increasing abstraction in their form, in their pictorial representation, as evidence of cultural degeneration. And of course, this then had the counter effect of transforming this art into an international symbol of anti-Nazism. And so through the 1930s, the prices went up. Many of these works were exported out of Germany. They were sent over to museums in the United States and elsewhere, and they became exhibited as exiled works of art. This debate about expressionism that Bloch undertook then was with his former friend Georg Lukács, the Hungarian philosopher. And it took place between the 1920s and 1930s, up to about 1938. Their argument really was about the question of political commitment, the question of whether the expressionist writers and painters, and expressionism really was the dominant form of modernist aesthetics in Germany at that time, whether they were being merely kind of selfish and solipsistic and just focusing on the individual, on the subject, and the interior world of our own landscape of feelings and emotions, or whether this art could actually add up to something greater, to some kind of political critique of capitalism. So if we take an exemplary painting to consider some of these aspects that they're arguing about, this is from Franz Marc, a 1911 painting, The Large Blue Horses. Marc was a leading member of de Blauer writer group, who were very important at the time. And as you can see from this image, then, we have a strong use of primary colours, reds, yellows, blues particularly, and some greens. The colour blue was very special for Franz Marc, as it was for Kandinsky and Ernst Bloch and others, because it had this sort of spiritual connotation. It was somehow a kind of mystical colour. It suggested something more nourishing for the soul than just cold technological modernity. You can see that form has been really abstracted, that the horses are just reduced to their most kind of essential features. And so there's this new language of form that Marc is developing. It's also, of course, not strictly speaking anatomically correct in terms of the structure, the anatomy of the horses, but really it's trying to evoke in us some sense of empathy. We want to feel with these horses. We want to imagine how they are feeling. And classically, for the expressionists, it returns us to nature. So it's very interested in primitivism. And this is partly where the fascists, the Nazis, had a problem with this kind of painting, because they wanted a kind of primitivism return to a nostalgic sort of feudal German past that was distinctly Aryan. And of course, the primitivism which most excited people like Marc was non-Aryan. It was African, Indonesian. It came from the South Pacific, from tribal art, from prehistoric forms of being, and European folk art as well. And then finally, the problem which Lukács and Bloch debate is this way in which expressionist paintings are supposed to reflect an inner state of mind through this external landscape of abstracted colour and form. And so Bloch saw figures like the Blauer writer, Kandinsky, Marc, and also Paul Klee as resembling something utopian, something that positive. And he contradicted Georg Lukács, who just said this is primitive art, it's harking back to a kind of religious world, and it doesn't have anything important to say to us. Another couple of examples here then, John Hartfield's photo montage pieces of Hitler and others, and Franz Marc's series Piggies. Artists like Franz Marc, then, for Bloch, were more than just decadent and liberal and bourgeois. Actually, they were closer to the native folklore of German tradition than previous artists had been. And so he called this folk closeness. And his point really was that this idea of primitivism was horrifying liberal art critics who found it really backwards and unsophisticated. And so that really was the utopian possibility for him. As we can see here, he talks about images of utopian uncovering. He refers specifically to Paul Cézanne's still life with a peppermint bottle. He says, "We can identify in this painting something new in the hollow spaces. This," he writes, "is no longer fruit, nor is it fruit modelled in paint. Instead, all imaginable life is in them. The thing becomes a mask, a concept, the deformed, denaturalised manner of secret teleotropisms, the human interior and the worlds shift together." He goes on to say that these objects, this still life, this fruit, is reborn to its essence as the inmost principle of its potentiality, of all our potentiality. I said that Bloch is difficult to read. I stand by that. But what he's talking about is that there is this utopian possibility that different kinds of times are contained within these images. And Picasso is a great example. The odd angles of the weeping woman contain various different moments of her moving, but they're all presented in this really flat kind of garish way. So there are all these different kinds of times jumbled up. But kind of crucially for Bloch, these experimental techniques understand the popularity of this kind of folksy, primitivist, popular consciousness. And he says that this is where their utopian kind of cultural surplus resides. It is in what he calls a non-contemporaneous recovery of images of the past repurposed into the present. That their project is composed of archaic images, but also images of the revolutionary imagination. So what does he mean by this? Is this just, as Lukács maintained, a kind of confusion of aesthetics, or is this really some guiding light of the future? So this relationship between the utopian imagination and a new politics of time. For Ernst Bloch, the expressionist writers and painters mixed up this specifically uniquely German cultural consciousness. They brought in archaic images with what he considered to be utopian material simultaneously, he says, without one being able to say precisely where the primeval dream stopped and the light of the future began. So the paintings and the poetry of the expressionist writers gives him a concrete example of some philosophical concepts around which I've been trying to talk. This play between lightness and darkness that he identifies across all of cultural heritage to find utopia even in the darkest places, even in the most unlikely places. In advertisements and travel agents' windows, walking down the street and seeing people dreaming about possible futures or just wishing they were somewhere else. But also in appeals to archaic images, medieval, romantic, and otherwise. In The Principle of Hope, Volume 3, he has a lengthy discussion about what he calls venturers beyond the limits. These are literary archetypes, he says, which are good examples of how you can repurpose a kind of cultural surplus from the past in a fictional sort of way. So the dreams of the characters we can see here, Odysseus from Homer's epic poem, Faust from the tragic play by Goethe, Don Quixote, the deluded knight from the chivalric romance who thinks he's going off to fight giants and really he's tilting his spear at the windmills, Don Giovanni from Mozart's opera and Prospero from Shakespeare's The Tempest. These, Bloch says, are all living utopians because they pursue the perfect life, because they demonstrate not only our human tendency to want to improve our lives and to get something better, but they have a conviction, he says, that the given cannot be the illuminatingly true. They are ceaseless in their utopian venturing. Faust is a good example of the man who seeks to grasp the infinite and embarks on this journey in which every pleasure he arrives at is then taken away from him, is expunged, and so he must seek and restlessly continue for another pleasure. And Bloch says this is like a kind of dialectical movement. Something is missing, Bloch writes, echoing Goethe's Faust. The fair moment is yet to come. And Don Quixote, he says, clearly the patron saint of honest, abstract social idealists like Charles Fourier and Robert Owen. Like the guiding images of antiquity, his dream articulates its own archaic element in the anachronism of a future world, anachronistic with the present. So the interesting thing about these figures, then, is that Bloch uses them to suggest that we need, in utopian anticipation, to think two times together at the same time. On the one hand, we have to think the time of this world in our present, the here and now, and on the other hand, we have to think the time of the utopian other world of the wish. This is a dualistic time structure, and these figures in literary antiquity, romantic figures, but also figures further back, the wise man, the warrior, the gentleman from older kind of fables, also exhibit this kind of binary time, if you like. These figures then function like messages in a bottle or like time machines, and their long-lost kind of ideas, their virtues, their values of honour, of chivalry, of obligation, become refunctionable into a new historical moment. They arouse in the reader a kind of loss, a kind of rediscovery or obligation, and a kind of longing. But is this really a new thing or an old thing? How are we supposed to understand this kind of double time, this sense of anachronism that Bloch keeps writing about? Is it both new and old simultaneously? And this really is the paradox of his philosophy, I would suggest. He insists on ideas about newness, futurity. He has a word, the novum, that he uses to try and sketch out what the new thing looks like, whether it's a political idea, whether it's a progressive social tendency for social justice, or whether it's a science fiction vision of a future technology that we haven't yet thought of or we can't even understand. And yet, at the same time, as a thinker, he's really attached to the literary canon, to Goethe, to Shakespeare, and to even older examples. And he's specifically interested in ideas around before the beginnings of capitalism. So that 16th century engraving by Kandel, which I've included there, is this image of the linden tree, which is something he comes back to. He talks about the way in which, in the medieval period, holidays are a moment outside of and a liberation from ordinary cyclical time, even before capitalism began. They're a kind of mode of festival and play inspired by Dionysian leisure, festivities, dancing, drinking, and so on. These are social wishful images of the past, undertaken in this sort of free time outside of work. And as we move into the capitalist period, the free time when you're away from having to work on the clock becomes incredibly important, and how we spend our free time to make the most use out of it starts to be seen in things like ideas, he says, around DIY. We must be more productive and we must improve our homes. Or we start having our allotments and growing our vegetables. These are very utopian ambitions and practices for Ernst Bloch. These are holidays from the real time of what the Greeks called chronos, and they offer up their own unique experience of lived time outside of daily life into half-sheltered spots, he says, that approximate kairos, a brief respite outside of capitalism's ceaseless self-production. In the holiday, he writes, certain traces of more fulfilled leisure have survived from older times, from pre-capitalist times, worthy of being considered and indeed possibly refunctioned under changed circumstances. So his point is that these older images of the linden tree, these kind of Dionysian pre-capitalist rites of celebration and festival, could be refunctioned within industrial capitalism in the late 19th and early 20th century. They could be re-energized. They announce a long cultural tradition of anticipating play, liberation, acting as a space and a time in which we can celebrate, but for which there only becomes real occasion later. So he talks about the way in which that dance of those workers around the linden tree could one day lead to the dance around the liberty tree of the French Revolution. So what we witness then in these images, these historical examples, he also cites medieval mystery plays there, is the future in the past. And so this is the idea that we can reach back into the kind of historical consciousness and pluck out particular images and repurpose them in a very politicized kind of way. And in this sense, Bloch bears some interesting similarities with the writings of Walter Benjamin, who also talks about historical memory and redemption, also in a Jewish messianic way, how we might propose alternatives to oppressive capitalism. And this brings us then, and I'll close with this point, although it might take me a little while just to kind of talk you through it, with this specific idea of time that Bloch develops. And this comes from the German term he uses, Ungleichzeitigkeit. It translates either as simultaneous uncontemporaneities, non-simultaneity, or non-contemporaneity. And it comes out of the text I mentioned earlier, Heritage of Our Times, published in 1935, a series of essays collected together that he wrote during the 1920s and 1930s. And it brings us back to the question of fascism. The essays in Heritage of Our Times examined the Weimar Republic's golden 20s and the emergence of the Nazi Party through a range of analyses of poetry, art, architecture, popular culture, and so on. Fascism, Bloch suggested, understood the importance of anachronistic and irrational myths in German popular culture, and the left's rejection, he's talking particularly about the German Communist Party, but also Marxists and Social Democrats more broadly as well. He says that the left rejected large parts of the peasantry, of the petite bourgeoisie in Germany, because they felt that they were too backwards, that they weren't going to be the agents of revolutionary social change. This class, then, is referred to as der Mittelstand, the German middle class, but it has a unique history, Bloch talks of. A class of workers who have come from peasant agricultural families. They many had moved into the cities after the First World War. And although they now live in an urban environment, they maintain strong connections with a rural background, with their traditions of folk culture, but also with pre-industrial heritage. And that's why he keeps talking about these anachronistic images that keep popping up. They were opposed to the political liberalism and cosmopolitan culture of the Weimar urban elites. And therefore, this class in particular epitomised his concept of Ungleichzeitigkeit, of non-contemporaneity. It's a class composed of modern and capitalist elements, but it's also composed of traditional pre-capitalist elements. As one historian, Geoffrey Herth, has argued, this analysis, then, that Bloch gives us, allows us to perceive a very complex relationship among this class in the 20s and 30s, which had selectively embraced some aspects of modernity, but it also desired technological redemption in line with traditional German nationalism. So it was also actually pretty conservative with a small c. Although the Mittelstand lived in the cities and worked in modern industry, memories of small-town life and less rationalised forms of production were still vivid in Germany in the 1920s. So these social groups, this class for Bloch, offers a resistance space to capitalism precisely because they have this odd historical pre-industrial heritage and because that heritage is not contemporaneous with industrial capitalism, with the Communist Party line, and with the urban working class being seen as the agent of social change, the industrial workers in the factories. It's a term and a concept that he develops out of Karl Marx's writings in a contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, where he talks about Gleichzeitigkeit, which refers to the standardisation of production processes in the factory, and that's what he means by contemporaneous. So just to move then towards a conclusion, I find curious echoes going back and reading Bloch's essays, and particularly this analysis of non-contemporaneity and this German middle-class consciousness, echoes with our own kind of odd situation in the UK at the moment, these geographical divisions, striations in some kind of urban-rural divide, which became sort of clearer and more muddy in the Brexit referendum question. Obviously, it was such a simplistic in or out question. It exacerbated tensions between people who live in the cities and people who live in rural areas, such as where I come from in Devon. And as we all know, perhaps from personal experience, as well as recent political discourse, these cultural fault lines cast into sharp relief real and also false distinctions between liberals and traditionalists, between city dwellers and those in the countryside. Bloch's utopian philosophy of time can, I think, perhaps help us to understand some of these contradictions. So I was really struck during the Brexit vote, the referendum, to think about places like Cornwall, where some of my family live. How can they reject, and how can Cornish fishermen reject European subsidies, which have kept much of their industry afloat, pardon the pun, at difficult times of global competition? How can Welsh villagers reject European, bureaucratic interference, but subsidies which have given special funding, shoring up post-industrial communities, welfare services, and so on? So I would suggest that his philosophy might help us get some kind of much-needed clear-sightedness to think about the complexities of time and of history that underpin often quite intangible ideas about culture, about values, tradition, but also hopes for the future. Thank you very much.